Welcome to Significant Bits. I'm Josh Bleeker Snyder. This episode is going to be the story of a fix that I sent in for the open source project whisper.cpp. The fix itself was not particularly large and not particularly interesting. I'm mostly going to use it as an excuse to tell you about how some of the transcription engines out there work, in particular, how whisper.cpp works, and about how related models work, like the LLMs that are taking the world by storm right now. And also a little bit about how I personally go about finding and fixing these kinds of bugs. Let's start with that last one. For quite a few years, I contributed to the Go compiler, including not just fixes, but new optimizations. And a question that people would ask me sometimes is, how do you find these optimizations? Where did you get the idea? Sometimes the answer was easy. Somebody filed a bug, and I looked into it and fixed it. The thing about people who file bugs about compiler optimizations is that frequently they come from significant pain. Something went wrong, the compiler emitted something that was really suboptimal, and it hurt. And those are great because it means that if you're going to fix it, somebody's really going to care. You're having a big impact, and even if that particular pattern of code doesn't show up all that often, it's still worth fixing. The harder one, in some sense, are cases in which you have slightly suboptimal code that shows up everywhere. Your frequency is a lot higher, even if your impact is a bit lower on a per instance basis. These are the sorts of suboptimal codes that can hide for a really long time. It's never painful enough that anybody goes and looks at them. So how do you find them? Well, you use my favorite kind of random algorithm, which is you look at a random bit of code, and if it turns out to contain the bug, probably that bug will be in lots of places. Doesn't always work. It's a pretty good first approximation. So what I would do is I would go find some bit of code that was interesting to me for some reason or another. Oftentimes it was code that was inside the standard library or inside the runtime itself so that I knew that somebody would care about its performance. After all, if you make appends faster, even if all you do is make appends faster, people will still care because appends happen so frequently. Or not. Or I would find some bit of code that somebody was asking about on a Slack channel somewhere, and I would go digging. And the way I would do it is I would find a short version of the code. Anything that was long is too hard, because I would stare at every single line of the code. I would understand exactly why that line of code was written the way it was. And sometimes the answer is actually to change the Go code, but oftentimes a better question is, how do I make this code that somebody wrote this way, that seemed natural to them to write this way, how do I make this code better? And then I would look at the output from the compiler. Every single instruction. Why is that instruction the way it is? And along the way, look at every single step and understand, why is it in this form as it works its way through the compiler? If you step systematically, bit by bit, understanding all of the details of this very small thing, it actually takes quite a long time, even for a small bit of code. But if you do this, you're almost bound to notice things that seem not quite right. Then what you do is you hack up some heuristics that just print how often does this pattern of code occur. Then you run your hacked up compiler over a decent corpus of code or just the standard library, and you see how often does an X show up. And if it shows up tens or hundreds of thousands of times, you've got something on your hand that matters, even if the actual performance improvement is pretty slight. Also, having gone through the trouble of understanding all the details of the code along the way, you're pretty well placed to understand how to go about finding a fix for it and how to think about generalizing it. Interestingly, in some ways, compilers are a lot like machine learning models in this regard. They seem really different superficially. Compilers are very precise, almost mathematical. They must have correct output, and machine learning models are pretty loosey-goosey. A machine learning model, you want to get mostly the right answer, and correctness is measured in terms of your error rate. If we measured compiler correctness in terms of an error rate, everyone would be rightfully horrified. And yet, if you don't think about compiler correctness, but compiler performance, there is, in some sense, an error rate. Your error rate will never get to zero. There will always be cases in which a sufficiently clever, super optimized compiler might do a better job, but it's not worth doing. Similarly, with machine learning models, you're not going to get your error rate to zero. You can just drive it down closer to zero. I spent some time working on machine learning maybe 15 years ago, around 2009. And this was when deep learning, which was at the roots of the modern machine learning and AI boom, was just starting to be a thing. And one of the things I noticed then was these models are really shockingly resilient. Maybe not shocking, they're designed to be resilient, but they are resilient. And interestingly, not only are the models themselves resilient, if properly trained, but the training algorithms are resilient, because these training algorithms, they're not designed in order to train specifically this kind of model. They're designed to learn the shape of any input. And one of the interesting aspects of this is it tends to hide bugs. I had a bug in how I was preparing my input to a machine learning model, and I didn't know about it, and everything still trained pretty well. My error rate was tolerable, and I just kept on going. And later, manually rereading some of the code, I noticed a relatively straightforward, fairly egregious bug, the kind that you would never have gotten away with in normal coding. But because it was a machine learning model, the model generalized around it. When I removed that bug, my model trained faster, and it got to a better place, but I could easily never have noticed that, because the training was pretty resilient. Similarly, in compilers, you often have a lot of supporting optimizations that all interlock, and if you miss an optimization, several other optimizations will kick in and mostly cover the tracks. Things will still be better with the optimization that you were missing, but it's resilient in a little way. This is why taking the time to carefully understand exactly what's going on with one concrete example can help you find bugs that are masked through the cooperation of lots of other resilient, helpful code that all operates on a spectrum. Enough philosophizing. Back to Whisper CPP. Let's do a bit of background on what the Whisper model is and how it works, because that will be important for understanding the fix that I sent in and how I found it. Whisper is a speech transcription model. The goal is to take audio in and extract the speech and emit it as text. There's quite a long history of transcription models dating to well before the current AI boom. I'm not an expert in the field, so I'm going to give you a superficial gloss on it, and it's possible that I've gotten some of the fine details wrong. I ask for your forgiveness in advance. As I understand it, the state of the art, going back quite some ways, was a hidden Markov model. The input to the hidden Markov model were a number of features that were extracted from the audio signal. These features were best guesses about what kind of phoneme or what part of a diphone or triphone, those are phoneme combinations, was present in that audio signal. Then you take a bunch of these features, one after the other, and you assume that they were generated by some hidden input, the text. You try to answer the question, what text would have resulted in the maximum likelihood of getting out this sequence of audio signals? Fast forward a bit. The next kind of model I'm going to mention is still an acoustic model. That is, we're still looking at input signals and trying to extract per input signal output and then post-processing that into some text. This is the Wave2Vec and Wave2Vec2 models. These models were trained on large quantities of unlabeled speech data, so they learned to recognize the overall shape of speech, and then they were trained on labeled speech. Now, one of the immediate problems that you're going to have when you're trying to do transcription is that your input and your output are not just in different modalities, but in some sense also in different lengths. There is some sense in which the lengths of your input and output are not even comparable because they're in different modalities, but there is another sense in which there's not a one-to-one correspondence between the sounds we make and the text that resulted it. For example, in the word hello, there are two L's when transcribed, but only one L sound. In the hidden Markov model, this gets taken care of in the hidden Markov part. In our Wave2Vec2 acoustic models, the way that we map between a per 20 millisecond chunk of audio and some output that ends up needing to get collapsed into a transcript is through a clever technique called the connectionist temporal classification. It's a fancy word, and I'll provide some links, including to a lovely visualization of it. But the core idea is that every 20 milliseconds of audio, our model is going to emit a best guess about a letter, and then we're going to take all of those guesses and we're going to dedupe them. So the model, if it hears a lot of S sounds, is welcome to emit S, 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 and we will unique them down to a single S. The model also has some special characters, like break characters. So if it wants to emit hello, and by say wants to emit, I'm anthropomorphizing, if the correct answer is hello, ideally, the model will emit some number of L's, followed by a break character, followed by some number of L's, followed by an O, followed by a space. And you can use this output to generate a training function for your model that will do a pretty good job. And as you can imagine, the sort of mistakes that the model makes is around the weirdnesses of English spelling. Sometimes it's just the quirks of the spelling, like, is that a K? Is it a CK? Is it two C's? And some of the quirks are around the challenges of semantics. If you hear the word eight, it is either spelled A-T-E or E-I-G-H-T. It's really hard to know which one of those without some broader context to tell you about the semantics of the word. E-I-G-H-T is also particularly problematic because that G, there's no sound in eight that corresponds very well to a G. So if you take a CTC model, like Wavetovec 2, the kinds of mistakes it makes are what you'd expect. Semantic things around homophones and English misspellings. You really want something that can take in a bigger context, something that can hear an entire word at a time or hear an entire sentence at a time so that it knows both which word it's trying to spell and also can bring to bear a bigger picture of the English language. By the way, models like Wavetovec 2 are often paired with external language models that take the output, that is a series of probability distributions over letters, and condition it on what a natural language model would say for English. So for example, if you said, I ate 8 cookies, your natural language model is going to help guide you over that probability distribution. And so when you get to the first 8, I ate, it's going to be guiding you towards ATE. And then that same probability distribution, when you get to the next 8, your natural language model is going to nudge you towards EIGHT. You can already imagine one of the troubles, of course, which is your language model is going to have an opinion about what you're going to say next. Your acoustic model is going to have an opinion about what it's hearing. And the question is, which one do you trust? Which one do you put more weight on? If you put a bunch of weight on your language model, you're going to hallucinate things. If you put a bunch of weight on your acoustic model, then you won't be taking enough interpretation from context, and you're likely to misspell things or transcribe things that don't make a lot of sense. So one of the big improvements that Whisper brought is it has an integrated language model and acoustic model. And like many of the fancy modern models that have all of our attention, Whisper is what's called an encoder-decoder model. Encoder-decoder models are helpful for cases in which you want to have lots of input, potentially of some varying length, and then from that generate some output, also potentially of a varying length, potentially of a different length than the input, or a different modality. And the way that an encoder-decoder model works is it takes your input piece by piece and iteratively accumulates it into a hidden state. And then it takes that hidden state and, piece by piece, iteratively generates output from it. And importantly, when it generates the output, it doesn't just generate output part one, output part two, output part three. It's also based on all of the things that you have emitted so far. For DALL-E, which lets you provide text and get out an image, your inputs is the text prompt that get accumulated into a hidden state, and then that hidden state is used to generate pixels. For LLMs, the input state is some amount of text, and the output state is some amount of text. For translation engines, your input is text in one language, and your output is text in another. And for Whisper, your input is a bunch of audio, and your output is some amount of text. Incidentally, Whisper can also do translation along the way. Now, as you think about generating output from your hidden state, we have to generate our output one piece at a time. Now, it's worth asking what each of these pieces are. Typically, when you're outputting text, each of these pieces are things called tokens. Instead of emitting one letter at a time, it can be helpful to let it emit a token, which is multiple letters at a time. And this happens because there's a lot of regularity and a lot of duplication in our language. So if you see ST quite a lot, it can save a lot of computational resources to be able to emit ST in one go instead of having to emit an S and then a T. Of course, all these models also include individual letters as tokens. So suppose we have our hidden state and we're ready to start emitting some tokens. We run our model and it's going to give us a bunch of logits, which are logarithms of probabilities, and it's going to give us all of these for every possible token. And implicit in this is a probability distribution, so maybe there's a 5% probability it thinks of an ST, and a 4% probability of just an S, and a bunch of long tail of other distributions. The obvious thing to do is to do a greedy extraction. Take the single highest probability first token, put it in your pocket, now say, okay, I've got a hidden state and I've got an ST, now giving me a new probability distribution over these tokens. Take the highest probability one and repeat. The trouble with greedy search is that sometimes it misses the best possible answer. The other problem is it tends to be fairly repetitive and boring and mundane. We're going to set aside the repetitive and boring and mundane problem, but I will just mention, for those of you who are messing with LLMs, if you've ever noticed that there is a temperature parameter that you can mess with, what that temperature parameter does is adds a fixed amount onto all of the logits, which effectively smooths out the probability distribution and encourages it to occasionally sample from lower probability tokens, which makes things quote-unquote more creative. What we'd really like to do is to take every possible continuation. So we could take the continuation that starts with S, and one that starts ST, and one that starts A, and one that starts AT, and we would like to assess the probability distribution over all of the number of outputs you can have. The problem here is obvious. You have a combinatorial explosion. You can't realistically explore all of the possible continuations. And you wouldn't really want to. The ones that are really unlikely are a waste of your time. So the approach that people take here is to do something called a beam search. And the idea behind a beam search is it's a depth-first search, but you limit the number of things that you're exploring, and you cull along the way. So for a beam of width 5, for example, you might take your 5 highest probability continuations, or you might sample your 5 highest probability continuations to make it possible to get things that aren't at the very top. But for the moment, we'll just assume we're greedily taking the top 5. And we say, okay, this is the 5 best first tokens. What comes afterwards? For each of these 5 best first tokens, we're going to ask, if this is the first token that we've emitted, then given our hidden state and that first token, what is the probability of each second token? Now, of course, since we're only considering up to 5 at a time, we really only care for each of the first tokens what the 5 best second tokens are. So we have 25 possible pairs. To avoid having 125 possible triplets, what we're going to do is we're going to take our 25 best pairs and we're going to keep the 5 best of those. Probably most of them will come from the very best first token, but some of them might come from other tokens. Now we'll have 5 best pairs. We'll go back and we'll say for each of these 5 best pairs, give me the 5 best third tokens. Again, now we'll have 25 possible triplets. We'll keep the 5 best triplets and we'll continue on like this. At each stage, we'll expand and then cull back down to 5. And what this enables is for longer sequences that are collectively more likely to survive the aggressive culling. If you make your beam really, really wide, you waste a bunch of resources because the probability that your 100th best token ends up being the beginning of some long sequence that overall is the most probable, that's not very high. But having a big enough beam search to discover slightly unlikely starts that turn out to be really good overall outcomes is important. Okay, that's the beam search. Let's go back to Josh tinkering with Whisper CPP. I was messing around with it, and I had a short 20-second clip. This 20-second clip include a bunch of disfluencies, ums and uhs, stutters, backtracking, and the like. And I was interested in having a transcript that included every single little bit of one of those. And Whisper CPP had a tendency to clean up the output. This sort of makes sense. If you ask people to transcribe a bit of audio, some people are going to transcribe it with every single repetition and every single disfluency, and some people are just going to clean it up and say, well, this is the core of what it says. I'll skip when they pause and said, I was interested in having all the disfluencies, and I was mildly frustrated that I was missing a bunch of them. So I did what every sensible engineer would do when faced with a brand new toy. I messed with all the parameters. And there's a lot of parameters, but the one that really seemed to move the needle was the beam search. Initially, it was small, and when I made it bigger, a wider beam, it started to emit more of the disfluencies. This makes some amount of sense. Some of the input sequences that you were trained on would have omitted that disfluency, so you might decide to discard it in the face of competition and just move forward. However, if you have a big enough beam search and you can take some tokens on those disfluencies and then still get back around to the really high likelihood that all the transcriptions would have agreed on, that the word car was there, well then, it might turn out that your overall transcription, including the disfluencies, is going to be better. So far, so good. I increased the beam search size, things got a little better. I increased the beam search size again, and I got a command line error message that said, nope, that's the maximum beam search size. So I did what every sensible engineer would do when faced with a complaint about a maximum value, is I went and grabbed the code and changed the maximum value. And all sorts of other stuff broke immediately. And I chased the other things down and I fixed that. And I confirmed that in fact, yes, a much bigger beam size did help a lot with my transcription. However, it was also a lot slower. So I reached back to my time doing machine learning ages ago, and I thought about how tiny little bugs can impair things. And I reached back to my compiler days, and I thought about how if I spend some time and go through, quote unquote, line by line here, I may be able to find something that was suboptimal, something that would enable me to get the output I wanted with a smaller beam size, which wouldn't involve having to hack up the code and also wouldn't involve the explosive computation times required to calculate with the wider beam size. So of course I did what every sensible engineer would do and started adding print statements. And as I added print statements, I noticed that a lot of the print statements I wanted were already in the code, controlled by a debug flag. This is great. Some people have strong opinions about leaving in debug print lines along the way, and they think that it clutters the code, and it rots, and it's annoying. I have to say, when, as a third party, as someone who doesn't understand your code base, picks up your code, having some print statements in there that were the ones that you thought were important and were helpful as you were debugging the code, as you write it, those are actually tiny little bits of gold because they help guide me, and I added a few of my own. And here, I relied a lot on Copilot and LLMs because I am not a C++ expert. This was simple enough that I could just tell it what I wanted to do, and oftentimes they could fill in the details. The fact that I could rely on Copilot and LLMs to do a bunch of this coding for me highlights two interesting facts about engineering. One, I've been told that at Google, the first thing you do when you're going to work with a language is you have to qualify for readability. That is, you have to qualify on your ability to even read the language before you can even start to write it. This might sound absurd, but in the case of Whisper CPP here, where I was having to interpret this foreign code base and interpret what Copilot was telling me was a good thing to write in here, the fact that I could read C++ even without being able to write it was enough. And the other thing it highlights is the importance of, as an engineer, taking the time to build your foundations. Even if Copilot can write your code for you, or you can get Claude or OpenAI to write your code for you, you won't know if it's right unless you have the foundation to understand what it's doing and why. Everyone always talks about how important it is to have readable code. This is a highlight of how important the skill of reading code is, and ever increasingly so in a world in which we write less and less of it. Having added a bunch of prints, I noticed something, which is just what I was hoping for. What I noticed was there appeared to be duplicates in the beam search. It was emitting great I, great I, great I, great Now, of those four potential continuations, three of them are identical. That seems pretty suboptimal. My whole goal in increasing the size of the beam for the beam search was to explore more possible continuations. And if three of the four possible continuations were identical, it's failing at that goal. And I thought, surely that can't be right. That's the sort of basic simple bug that all of the other powerful machinery is covering up, but that is standing in my way of getting the output I want with a small beam search. So I went digging around through the code trying to find the place where deduplication occurs. I got distracted for a while investigating something called patience. I'll leave a link to it in the notes for people who are interested. I only highlight it because as I describe how I work, I don't want people to walk away being like, boy, Josh is a genius. He went straight to the answer. Like, nope, I got pretty distracted. I wandered off here and wandered off there and took some time to learn about patience and learn about other things around the beam search. So I went and poked around and found the place where the beam search deduplication occurs. And it worked in more or less the way that you would expect. It has a list of possible continuations and it needs to narrow them down. And as it steps through them one by one, it also looks to see, hey, is this the same as one I've already got? And the way it looked to see if it was the same as a previous one was a little interesting. Put yourself in the shoes of somebody who is very clever and is interested in efficiency. What you might do as you go through to decide, hey, are these two sequences of tokens the same? Well, the obvious thing to do is to step token by token and see if they're the same. The thing about this is going to be linear in cost. It's pretty cheap. I mean, every one of these tokens is just an ID, and they're all dense in memory, and so you're just comparing them one at a time. But you might worry, gee, this is going to end up being quadratic. So you might say, well, I really want to just do an O of one comparison to see whether two sequences are the same as I step through in the beam search. Another way to do this is to have something like a rolling hash. So every time you add an ID into your sequence, you hash it in. And now, two sequences are the same if they have the exact same hash. So that's guaranteed to be linear, but your hashes are going to be pretty expensive compared to all of this other work. It might even be cheaper, actually, to do the linear token-by-token comparison. But suppose you were really clever. You might say, you know what? Each of these sequences has a probability assigned to the entire distribution occurring. And these probabilities come out of these giant, giant series of matrix multiplies. The odds of two of these probabilities being exactly the same for two completely different sequences is really low. So you know what let's do? Let's use the cumulative probability for this sequence as its hash. It took me a while to figure out that this was what was going on, because the code looked really weird. It said, okay, we're going to take all of our candidates for our beam search, we're going to organize them by their cumulative probability, and then every time we see one with the same probability, we're going to skip over it. And I said, well, why should you skip over it? It turns out this is them being clever to try to avoid duplicates, but it wasn't working. Some of these had very slightly different probabilities, despite the fact that the sequence was exactly the same. So I went and I hacked in the linear comparison and say, okay, let's just look at the tokens instead. And I confirmed that, in fact, yes, if I do a linear comparison of the tokens one by one, I get the improved output on my 22nd input with all my disfluencies, but the same beam search size. And there's uniqueness all along the way. I thought, great, problem solved. And then I thought, I don't know, have I found the real bug? I don't necessarily want to send a stranger a pull request that implements a, you know, quadratic algorithm to work around something. Like, maybe I need to dig deeper and be responsible. So I thought, okay, let's figure out why these cumulative probabilities are, in fact, slightly different. This was a giant distraction. I spent hours digging, adding more print statements, and understanding exactly where these differences come from. After all, this is the sort of thing that's should be easy to find in the code, right? Like, you're running these giant matrix multiplies with the same input, and yet somehow their output is different based on what order they are in the input. There must be some place where somehow the input order matters, and that would stand out like a sore thumb in the code. So I dug and I dug and I dug, and I debug printed and I debug printed. And ultimately, I came to the conclusion that I had no idea. I ruled some things out. I ruled out a threading bug because I disabled threading. And when I tested it on the CPU, as opposed to offloading the work to the GPU, I couldn't reproduce the bug. And finally, I thought, all right, It's just a bug in the GPU implementation of the matrix multiplies. This is not surprising. It's totally different code. They handle floating point a little bit differently. And I said, I've reached the end of what I can do here. So I went and filed the bug against WhisperCPP. And I said, here's the input. Notice if you run GPU versus CPU, you get these different results. And it matters because it messes up our beam search. And the maintainer, to his great credit, responded within a day or two and said, actually, that's expected. Not a CPU-GPU thing. It has to do with how we generate the outputs. I'm not going to go into it here, both because it would take a long time and because I'm not enough of an expert to give you a sparklingly clear elucidation, but I will add a link to folks who are interested in learning about it. So I said, okay, well, it's not a bug, but the beam search is slightly broken. What do you think about me doing this quadratic thing? Quadratic, but dirt cheap. And he came back, yep, that seems good. So it turned out my original fix was good. And it was just a few lines of code to implement this very simple comparison. I shipped it off upstream. It improved my example considerably and generally should improve in a small way the output of WhisperCPP for everyone who uses it. Now, those of you who have listened to me ramble about machine learning before or who are steeped in the stuff might be wondering, hey, what about the bitter lesson? The bitter lesson is a paper worth reading. It's very short. And what it argues is we have a long history in the world of machine learning of trying to bring human intelligence to the world in how we design our models. And the history of machine learning suggests the more that we simply throw more data and more computation and more general techniques at the problem, the better the outputs that we get. The bitterness here is around the frustration of having our human expertise not matter. In the end, the power of data and scale swamps everything else. And so the big question is, what techniques do we have that we know can scale? And so far, search and learning appear to be two pretty good ones. Given the bitter lesson, what am I doing digging around inside WhisperCPP? My time would be better spent figuring out how to get more data and how to train more powerful models. Be that as it may, there's still room for engineering. There may be less room for human expertise in designing these models, but engineering is often the art of trade-offs. This whole thing started because I didn't want to increase the beam size because it would slow down my models. More powerful models would slow down my models. And this is in some sense really orthogonal to the machine learning model itself. This is just cleaning up the inputs and the outputs. You might really have the same question about compilers. What's the point of improved compiler optimizations when CPUs continue to get faster year over year? And it is a very fair question. It's one of the reasons that I stopped working on compilers so much. However, compiler improvements ship today. They help with the code that you are working on. And they do, in some sense, make a systematic difference on a moment-to-moment comparison between different languages in the world we operate in. And yes, the accumulated compiler improvements over the last 30 years are utterly swamped by the accumulated improvements in Moore's Law, and I fully expect that improved transcription engines will utterly swallow the tiny little fix that I made to WhisperCPP, but I want my disfluencies, and I want them now, and it was a day well spent. Everyone has their own techniques for tackling these things, but if you're messing with compilers, you're messing with machine learning, or you're working in one of these other areas where there's this wide gray area where once correctness is taken care of, there's still room for improvements. For example, user experience. You might have a pretty good user experience, but if you were to watch a user interact with your website or your app and break it down piece by piece, exactly what steps they did, exactly where they got stuck, you might find that there are high frequency, low individual impact things you can improve that have a significant overall meaningful improvement. If you're working in one of these areas where there's a big wide gray area, take your time, go step by step, track down a thing that's wrong, figure how to make it better, and repeat. Yet again, as always, thanks for listening to me ramble. One of the other lectures that I like to give people around me is how engineers systematically underestimate the importance of marketing. And I know this because I do it myself. So, despite the fact that it pains every fiber of my being, I'm going to remind you, as a listener, hey, you should share this podcast with your friends if you like it. Like and subscribe, et cetera, et cetera. All right, I did it. Please share. I'll see you all next time.